From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, film director Fred Skepsy. He was one of the leaders of the Australian New Wave in the 70s. His films include Six Degrees of Separation, The Russia House, Roxanne, The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, and his latest, IQ, starring Meg Ryan and Tim Robbins. Also today, Twitch and Shout, a new documentary about Tourette syndrome. We meet the film's narrator, Lowell Handler. He's a photojournalist who has Tourette syndrome. We've been hearing a lot about Motown lately, with founder Berry Gordy's autobiography and the Temptations CD box set. Gerald Early has a commentary which considers the meaning of Motown to African-American listeners. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A major power outage has stalled Newark International Airport. Officials say a worker accidentally cut through three major cables that feed power to terminals at the busy airport. The air traffic control tower is not affected, but baggage carousels, jetways, and security X-ray machines are not working. Most flights into and out of the airport have been canceled. Officials say service won't be restored before late tonight. Severe winter weather is battering Northern California. Heavy rain is triggering flooding, power outages, and landslides on the coast. Blizzard conditions have closed roads in the Sierra Nevada mountains. From member station KQED, Jason Bobian reports.
Over 7 inches of rain fell in some parts of Northern California over the weekend, and weather forecasters predict the storms will continue through Friday. The deluge pushed many rivers over their banks, causing evacuations, closing highways, and shutting down schools. The Russian River, just north of San Francisco, is rising and is expected to crest at 16 feet above flood level. National Guard troops, some using helicopters, are being called in to evacuate residents. A spokesperson for Pacific Gas and Electric Company says close to 13,000 customers in Northern California have lost their electricity. In addition, winds of up to 90 miles per hour have pounded the coast, and blizzard conditions have intermittently shut down major roads in the Sierra Nevadas. For National Public Radio, I'm Jason Bobian in San Francisco.
The jury in the O.J. Simpson murder trial will be sequestered starting Wednesday. Judge Lance Ito has told the jurors to pack their bags. He says the court will try to make them as comfortable as possible, but it won't be a picnic. The trial could last for months. Simpson is being tried in the stabbing deaths of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend, Ronald Goldman. The French government has brushed aside American and British criticism of Paris's decision to open a diplomatic mission in Iraq. French officials say the two countries also have contacts with Iraq. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Foreign Ministry spokesman Richard Duquet said the government was surprised by the reaction in Washington and London to the French decision. He said those governments also have diplomatic contacts with Iraq. Duque said the American reaction was especially astonishing since the United States has had a so-called interest section at the Polish embassy in Baghdad since 1991. The spokesman said the only difference with the French mission is that it'll be staffed by a French diplomat. Duque also brushed aside British criticism that it had not consulted its allies in the European Union. The spokesman said France had informed its partners of its decision before the announcement was made public. France announced the decision during an official visit here by Iraq's deputy prime minister. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
British comic actor Peter Cook has died. He was 57. His film roles include The Wrong Box, Bedazzled, and Yellowbeard. On Wall Street, the Dow has fallen 3 points to 3,864. The Nasdaq is up 2. This is NPR. Jurors are being chosen for the federal conspiracy trial of 12 people accused of planning an Islamic holy war against New York sites. One of the defendants is Sheikh Oman Abdel Rahman, who is accused of supporting the men who bombed the World Trade Center nearly 2 years ago. Potential jurors are being asked questions about religion, ethnicity, and the Trade Center blast. Courtroom security is heavy. Police are on 24-hour guard. Government biologists say they might release wild Canadian wolves in central Idaho or Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming as early as Wednesday. The releases are part of a government program designed to reintroduce wolves to the American West. NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
It was another government program that led to the wolf's demise in the American Rockies. The predators were killed off 60 years ago to protect sheep and cattle. Today, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologists are walking trap lines with Canadian trappers in Alberta, where there's a surplus of wolves. The biologists are also trying to locate, track, and capture wolves from aircraft. 7 have been captured so far, including 3 from the same pack. They could be released in Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming, where biologists want to release wolves in packs. Lone wolves are scheduled for release in central Idaho. The biologists hope to release 15 wolves in each location as soon as possible, in time to den and breed this year. One wolf was inadvertently killed yesterday when a tranquilizer dart pierced its lungs. This is Howard Berkus reporting.
The Supreme Court has upheld a large award in a silicone breast implant case. The justices have rejected an appeal by implant maker Dow Corning. A California jury awarded a woman more than $7 million after her doctors told her the implants ruptured after reconstructive surgery. The leaking gel had possibly caused a painful tissue disease. She accused Dow Corning of rushing development of the implants. Dow Corning says the case is based on junk science. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Fred Skepsy directed the film IQ, a romantic comedy about Albert Einstein rescuing his niece from marrying an intelligent boor, leading her instead into the arms of an auto mechanic with heart. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has his reservations about the new film, but in a 1993 profile, he described Skepsy as probably the least known great director working in the mainstream American cinema. Skepsy also directed the films 6 Degrees of Separation, The Russia House, A Cry in the Dark, Roxanne, and The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith. He grew up in Melbourne, Australia, and now divides his time between Melbourne and the U.S. The Australian film industry has made its impact on Hollywood. Little Women is directed by Australian Gillian Armstrong. Driving Miss Daisy was directed by Australian Bruce Beresford. The Australian film Priscilla, Queen of the Desert was an art house hit in 1994. Skepsy was one of the directors who led the way as part of the Australian New Wave of the 70s. I asked him what changed in the 70s.
Australian film had really come to a standstill. We made a lot of films in the 40s and then up to the mid-50s, and somewhere in the mid-50s it all stopped dead. And there are a number of reasons for that. Budgets, international selling of film, and then a stranglehold that both the English and the Americans got on our exhibition and distribution system. And I mean a real stranglehold. In a way, we were locked out of our theaters. And I think that the systems or the studios that were set up were somehow waiting for things to come to them rather than initiating them. And it took a new generation, if you like, to come through to start that process again. And I guess, you know, we were youthful, exuberant, and ignorant, and arrogant, and all those things, and just cut through the mess and went for it. We didn't know how much trouble we could get into.
Did you lose a lot of money?
I didn't get rich out of it, shall we say. No, on one film I did okay, on the other film I lost everything, so... But to do it, you know, like when I was doing Devil's Playground, for instance... I raised half the money myself, and then I had to raise that much money again to release it because nobody here wanted to release it. So I hired my own cinemas and did the whole advertising campaign with some friends of mine, and we, you know, exhibited and distributed it ourselves. And when Australians went in to see the films, they liked them. The other thing is, you know, that is often not credited for what happened in Australian film, is that television came in here in 1956, and thanks to some sensible government regulations insisting on a certain amount of local material, we had our own program starting to come through in the early 60s, so that particularly for the latter half of the 60s, there were quite a few, even though they were imitation cop shows and things, there were quite a few Australian programs, and some kind of original comedies and some wonderful review shows. And Australians stopped becoming embarrassed about seeing themselves on screen. In fact, they started to like it. But what they found as they started to watch television, is that they liked to see the action taking place on their own streets, that they understood that it wasn't unglamorous to see, you know, your real world up on screen in the way you'd been seeing the worlds of America or England or France or other places. And I think that sort of took away some of our embarrassment. Now, incidentally, some of this is also caused, you know, by a lot of our films for a while were not well acted. And I think it helped take that away too, you know, that there was a consistency, a standard coming out. I remember the day that Peter Weir's film, Picnic at Hanging Rock, was released, and I drove into the city to see, you know, what was going to happen. And there were queues for four blocks. Now, there really hadn't been an enormous amount of publicity, but there was something in the air about that film. And you could tell right there that Australians just wanted to see their own history, their own culture, their own voice on screen, finally. And they queued up for weeks to do it, and it was the most exciting thing I'd seen.
One of your early films, The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, was based on something that happened in Australian history. It's set at the turn of the century and was about a man who's half Aboriginal and who tries to assimilate into white society. And when everything overwhelms and frustrates him, he kind of goes on a rampage and massacres several white people. What reaction did you get to that part of, to that story from Australian history? Was that what people wanted to see?
Nope, unfortunately.
Is that the movie you lost everything?
That's the one I lost the money on. there is a fantastic film just been made in New Zealand called Once Were Warriors, which I had the good fortune to see a couple of days ago. Now, in New Zealand, that's apparently enormously successful. About two-thirds of all New Zealanders have been to see it. You know, it's a film that's a modern version of Jimmy Blacksmith, if you like. It's about what happened to the Maori society and how violent their lives are and how violent their personal relationships are. So I don't know what the difference was. Maybe people just weren't ready for it here. When Jimmy Blacksmith came out, the violence in Jimmy Blacksmith is very anti-violence. And so it happens when you least expect it to the people you'd least want it to happen to. And it's very quick. And that upset a lot of people. In fact, on the major morning newspaper in Melbourne, they wrote an article just about that violence on starting on the second page, and it ran the whole third and fourth page of the paper. And, you know, it was things like that that happened all around the country that I think kept people away from the film. They were too frightened to go and see it.
If you lost everything on the movie The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, why did you make another film? What gave you the courage... And where'd you get the money?
Well, I told you we were brash, young, arrogant, and stupid. no, I went to America shortly after that because I couldn't afford to do it anymore. So I had a kind of an idea that if I went to America and maybe made a name for myself making films there, that would help me to, you know, do more with Australian films and get, you know, get a better release because I'd be known a bit more. And also I wanted to test myself against that system to see what it had to offer, what that kind of filmmaking could do, you know, if I incorporated it in what I did. And then you get, you know, then you get caught up in a different set of problems, don't you?
Yeah, well, I'm interested in how you reacted to that different set of problems. You know, you were... working very independently in Australia, no big film system to back you up, you're losing your own money. And then you come to America and you're working with the American system, which, as you say, has problems of its own. How did you fit in?
It took a while. I had written something and I don't think it was mainstream enough. I don't think it was quite understood enough. What I did find was that, in general, in America and the major studio mainstream, people say they want you for your originality, but what they really want you for is to freshen up the genres that they make pictures in. And so I found myself doing, for instance, it's a longer story than this because there were six or seven projects involved before I did Barbarossa, but I found myself doing a Western because people thought Jimmy Blacksmith was a great Western. Now, I never for one second considered Jimmy Blacksmith to have anything to do with being a Western. And I think I find that's the hardest thing, is that people want to sort of stay in the narrowness of a genre and are frightened if you try and do the unexpected, because they go through a thing called a preview process. And the preview process, you know, is where you give audience cards that are like a foolscap sheet with questions on both sides and almost suggestions as to how you answer. And you suddenly turn somebody who's just had, hopefully, a spellbinding experience and should be in a semi-hypnotic state if you've done it well enough. You're suddenly asking them to be rational about strictly emotional things, and you get them to say what they liked and what they didn't like, etc. And, you know, you put a lot of things in a film that you don't want people to like. So if they write down they don't like it, that's successful. But then what you see people doing is they read that in when they summarize the preview cards, and they want that out of the film. Anything that's slow, anything that doesn't move fast enough, doesn't have enough overt action or whatever, you know, you suddenly find people want it out of the film. If you've built up a character that you want people to like, and then he's going to die because that's going to make you hate somebody else, etc., that upsets the audience, so they want that out of the film, you know. And certainly on my first couple of films, Barbarossa and Iceman, the preview process made them lesser films than they really were.
My guest is Australian film director Fred Skepsy. His films include IQ, 6 Degrees of Separation, The Russia House, and A Cry in the Dark. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Australian film director Fred Skepsy. I think my favorite of your films is 6 Degrees of Separation. And that was adapted from a John Gare play. And in the movie, Will Smith from Fresh Prince of Bel-Air starred as a young man who's impersonating, he's pretending that he passes himself off as Sidney Poitier's son. And he basically insinuates himself into the lives of some very wealthy people and puts on what turns out to be quite a performance for them, because they're totally fooled by this identity that he's put on. I thought Will Smith really gave an excellent performance in the film, but I was wondering if he was cast because he was on a studio list or because if you knew that he'd be giving such a fine performance. You know what I mean? Sometimes the studios...
No, I know exactly what you mean.
...tell you who you have to cast in order to get the money to make the film.
Well, here's the truth of it. Will Smith had just done a film with Arnon Milchan in San Francisco. It's the one with, I think, Whoopi Goldberg and Ted Danson, mm-hmm. Where he was a test tube baby and wanted to find his father. Anyway, they had liked him so much, and they liked his television success, that... He, in fact, was the money hook, that if we got Will to be in the film, then we would definitely get the money. It gave them a marketing hook that they didn't feel they otherwise had, particularly if we were going with Stockard Channing, you know, who's an absolutely wonderful actress, but not that well known in the world of film. It wasn't then a case of us going out and saying, righto, Will, you've got the job. You know, he came... with one of the people from Arnon Milchan's company, dressed up very well, which he doesn't normally do, and trying to be that person. And he really presented himself and showed himself to be willing also to go through what I felt was a necessary training process before we did it. I was very impressed with him, but it didn't stop there. I did actually interview something like 15 other major actors, and he won the part just as much on his ability and his persona as he did on being a name. And then he went to see the play, he went to see it in Los Angeles, and then I took him across to England to see it there and to see how differently it could be done. And then he underwent a 12-week training program, both with an actor's coach and with a dialect coach, working on exercises and learning how to talk like an educated person from Philadelphia. He went through that very, very seriously. And then we used to get together once a week and see what stage he was at. And depending what stage he was at, we would then go through one or two scenes and talk about the various approaches that could be taken with those scenes and try different things so that he got a real healthy understanding that there was more than one way to look at it, and that what was being said sometimes had very little to do with what was actually going on.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you how dedicated he was to it.
Yeah, I really thought it was a fine performance. I have read, there's a scene in the film, it turns out that the character is gay, and there's a scene in the film where he comes on to a young straight man and kisses him. Mm-hmm. And as it turns out, Will Smith was really uncomfortable doing that, so uncomfortable that I think he asked you if he could do the scene without the kiss. Did you have any idea he'd have that reaction?
No, we talked about that up front, right up front. It was almost one of the first things. I said, you have to do this, 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 and this in the film. Are you going to be able to do that? Will you do that? He lied. No, he was very keen, to get the job. I think the truth is, as the time came nearer, Will's from a pretty macho world, and he was under a lot of pressure as well within his own world, rightly or wrongly. Let's forget political correctness for a moment. There's his own version of political correctness from within his own circle of people, and there was a lot of pressure, believe it or not, from people on Will to not do this because they see him as a role model, and they didn't think, again, rightly or wrongly, that this was what a role model in the black community should be doing.
So how did you resolve this with him?
We did a lot of talking about it, and, I just kept trying to put it into its proper perspective, that it really... that perhaps he was being forced into a distorted point of view and letting it get out of proportion, and that he was an actor. And, and also that film is an illusion and there's a way of creating what you need without always having to do it, something that seems to be forgotten sometimes in film.
So how did you shoot the kiss?
Cleverly. It's shot in a way that it looks like it's happening and it feels like it's happening, and it isn't necessarily.
So he never really came.
But a couple of times, but a couple of times it is. Yeah, no, he did it.
Well, I thought you said it looks like it's happening, but it's not really happening.
Well, he does it in some scenes and not in others.
Right. Okay. I know your first film, The Devil's Playground, was based on some of your experiences, I believe, as In a Roman Catholic boarding school and in a seminary?
It's a monastery. Yeah.
Monastery, yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So were there movies that you really wanted to see that you weren't allowed to see because of your religious training?
Yeah, absolutely.
And did that make it even more exciting, the thought of movies and making movies?
Ingmar Bergman's, I think it's One Summer of Happiness. I might have this wrong now, but there was a film that was on the list, shall we say. Have you ever heard of that? I think you have that in America.
Right,
as well.
This is the list of movies you're not supposed to see.
Yeah, but it's called The List, you know, it's like a title that means, you know, if you go, you're committing a mortal sin. I don't know who decided this. And there was a certain kind of thing, you know, you can get excommunicated and all that sort of stuff if you did this wrongly or too often or something. And so I went to see this film, which was on the list, knowing full well what it meant. And I thought it was going to be because of the sexuality, of which there was so little that from that point of view I was disappointed. However, I saw a really fantastic film. So when I came out afterwards, I went, well, why was that on the list? Why have I got into, you know, all this sort of moral trouble because of this? And it turns out that they were satirizing priests, satirizing the country priest. And I hadn't even noticed.
Yeah.
I said, you're kidding me. I couldn't believe it. So there was an attraction because of that, I guess. But actually, I was quite lucky. Like in the seminary, there was an extraordinary, the man was a Marist brother, not the seminary, the monastery. The man was a Marist brother, and, you know, they used to get films in, but this man, you know, taught Latin and English and geography and stuff. He was a highly intelligent man who had, you know, who loved great literature and loved films that reflected great literature. So we actually got exposed to some quite terrific films because of him. You know, now I'm 13 at this time, you have to remember. And, you know, for instance, on Saturday nights, this man would teach us about music, and every Saturday night he would take a different instrument, and you know, you would have our sort of common room covered with drawings and photographs and things of that instrument, and then play great orchestral pieces, and our instructions were not to listen to the whole music but to listen only to that instrument and what its role was within the whole, and things like that. I mean, the man was an incredibly stimulating person, and you know, I think that had that helped me personally a lot to do what I'm doing now.
Fred Skepsy, his latest film is IQ. He spoke to us from Australia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Lowell Handler says he's often mistaken for an alcoholic or a drug addict because of his sometimes bizarre-seeming behavior. Handler has Tourette syndrome. Coming up, we meet Lowell Handler. He's the narrator and producer of the new documentary, Twitch and Shout, about people with Tourette syndrome. Also a commentary on the meaning of Motown. Gerald Early, professor of African and Afro-American Studies at Washington University, reflects on Motown music and the different meanings it's had for whites and blacks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton is getting busy to prepare for his State of the Union address, which he'll give later this month, UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
White House spokesman Mike McCurry says the president is putting together the outline of his speech to be delivered to a joint session of Congress January 24th. Aides say it will be a lively speech and that Mr. Clinton will draw some lines on welfare reform, the popular balanced budget amendment proposal, and a middle-class tax cut, which the president prefers to call a middle-class bill of rights. All three items are included in the House Republicans' contract with America, but are short on specifics. The president and congressional Democrats have called on Republicans to spell out their proposed spending cuts to balance the budget by the year 2002. House Republican leaders say that won't happen before the balanced budget amendment is introduced on the 19th, and Democrats know it. Carol Van Dam, The White House.
In California, Republican Governor Pete Wilson will deliver his State of the State message later today. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
Along with his re-election as governor of California, Pete Wilson spent the weekend celebrating the state's steadily improving economy. Unemployment dropped 0.3 of a point last month to 7.4%, though that's still 2% above the national unemployment rate. Wilson believes California's economy will rebound even faster if taxes are cut. In his State of the State speech, he's expected to advocate a 5% reduction in the state income tax. It's sure to be a controversial idea in the legislature, but Wilson has a lot of political capital right now. A year ago, with the state still reeling from recession, his re-election appeared to be doomed. But his trouncing of his Democratic challenger, Kathleen Brown, and the gains made by Republicans in the state assembly have made Pete Wilson once again a force to be reckoned with. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
Authorities have found two more automobiles among the wreckage of a multi-vehicle crash in Arkansas that has claimed the lives of five people. Ben Fry, member station KUAR, reports.
Officials now say a van and a motorhome have been found among the wreckage along Interstate 40, just northwest of Little Rock. That brings to 10 the number of vehicles involved in the pileup. Eight tractor-trailer rigs were also strewn along a quarter mile of the interstate. The accident occurred at 2 o'clock this morning when a wall of heavy fog covered the freeway. A trucker from Virginia who arrived on the scene of the accident said it looked like a bloody murder. Authorities say the chain reaction crash set fire to paint in one of the trucks, causing an explosion. Five of the semis were carrying livestock, leaving the carcasses of cattle strewn along the highway. The local sheriff says the interstate has been closed while emergency crews clear the wreckage from the highway. For National Public Radio, I'm Ben Fry in Little Rock.
Stock prices were mixed today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 6 points to close at 3,861. In the broader market, advances led declines in heavy trading. This is NPR. Jurors in the murder trial of O.J. Simpson will be sequestered starting Wednesday. Judge Lance Ito has told the jurors to be ready to go to a secret location. Meanwhile, Simpson is reportedly about to join the publishing frenzy connected to the trial. He's co-authored a book called I Want to Tell You. From Los Angeles, Kitty Feldy has more.
The book is co-authored by film director Lawrence Schiller, who says it is O.J. Simpson's response to the 300,000 pieces of mail he's received since he was arrested for the murder of his ex-wife and another man. In the book, Simpson reportedly declares he did not murder Nicole Brown Simpson and talks about allegations of spousal abuse. On Wednesday, prosecutors will argue in court that evidence of domestic violence should be part of Simpson's murder trial. Fred Goldman, the father of one of the murder victims, called the book, quote, another disgusting attempt at commercialism coming from the defendant. It's perhaps even more outrageous. Meanwhile, it is unclear whether Simpson will have to forfeit any of the proceeds from the book under California's new law that forbids a criminal from profiting from his crime. For National Public Radio, this is Kitty Feldy in Los Angeles.
New York Cardinal John O'Connor says he won't support the Boston Cardinals' call for a temporary halt to anti-abortion demonstrations outside clinics. O'Connor says he won't act to stop the protests unless all abortions are stopped, too. Boston Cardinal Bernard Law called for the moratorium on protests outside clinics after two women were killed in two Brookline clinics. The Secretary of Transportation says the airline industry's goal must be zero accidents. There were seven fatal commercial aviation accidents last year. 264 people died. Federal aviation officials are gathered in Washington, meeting with hundreds of officials from airlines, labor unions, and aircraft firms. Secretary of Transportation Federico Peña is reminding the officials air traffic is still 30 times safer than driving on interstate highways. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lowell Handler, has been documenting the lives of people who live with the condition he has, Tourette's syndrome. It's a genetic neurological disorder which creates involuntary movements, noises, and thoughts. Sometimes the symptoms include uncontrollable swearing and obsessive-compulsive behavior. Handler was diagnosed in 1981 when he was 24 years old and in his last year of college studying to be a photographer. After the initial emotional upheaval, Handler decided to deal with his condition as a photographer. He spent part of 1988 traveling with neurologist Oliver Sacks, taking pictures of people with Tourette syndrome who Dr. Sacks was writing about. Now Handler is the associate producer and narrator of a documentary about people with Tourette syndrome called Twitch and Shout. It was shown at the Museum of Modern Art last week and will be shown next summer on the PBS documentary series POV. I asked Handler to describe his symptoms.
I guess I have a lot of different symptoms. I mean, I have a lot of vocal symptoms. I have a lot of noises I make. I have a lot of kind of barking sounds that I make. I have a lot of physical movements, a lot of twisting and turning, a lot of jerky movements of my arms and legs and torso. It's basically, that's what Tourette is. I mean, it's a movement disorder, and it's a disorder that involves an inability to inhibit, and not only to inhibit movement, but also to inhibit thoughts and words and actions and speech and noises and so forth.
What goes through your mind when you go through one of the twitches, like when you stamp your foot or when you thrust your arm out?
Mm-hmm. What goes through my mind?
Yeah. Are you conscious of what's happening, or is it an involuntary?
Well, it's involuntary. Sometimes I can sense it ahead of time, and sometimes it just jumps out. But what goes through my mind isn't any different than what goes through anybody else's mind. There's no particular thought process. There's no,
I guess I'm wondering this. When you're... arm gets thrust out, or when you stamp your foot, are you thinking, I'm going to stamp my foot now, or are you thinking, oops, I just stamped my foot?
No, neither, really. It just happens. I don't think of myself as really any different than anybody else, except that the only reminder, and it's a constant reminder of how I am different than everybody else, is people's reaction to me. But if there was nobody to react, or for instance, when I'm around a group of people who've known me for many years, there's no difference at all, because they're not reacting, and so I have no mirror.
How much compulsive behavior do you have, and what kind of behavior is that?
The compulsive behavior is one of the most disturbing aspects, I think, of Tourette syndrome. But it's not something that everybody with Tourette has. Certainly, I think a large percentage of people who have Tourette do have it. And that involves, all kinds of things like touching objects, touching people, kicking things, and certain tics or involuntary movements can kind of be... It's kind of difficult sometimes to distinguish what is a tic, an involuntary movement, a manifestation of the Tourette, or what's a sort of compulsive action.
Mm-hmm. Now, I find it interesting. In your movie, you say that a lot of people
lose their symptoms when they're absorbed in their work. And, and that with you, too, when you're taking pictures, you're not likely to get, you know, the ticks and the noises that can interrupt you during the rest of daily life.
Yeah, that's true.
Is there any explanation for that?
I don't know what the scientific explanation is. I think that I'm not sure, really. I really don't know the answer to that. I know that the symptoms just tend to dissipate when one is involved in an activity and they're really concentrating.
So that must make it very appealing to work a lot.
Yes, I like photographing and I like working, and it keeps me happy.
Well, you know, I interviewed your brother.
Yeah, but am I the first Tourette-er you've ever interviewed?
Yes, you are.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you are. And I interviewed your brother, I forget if it was a year or two ago, when he was
Evan.
Doing... Yeah, your brother Evan Handler, and he was doing a one-person show in New York about the years that he had leukemia.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, he had said that, you know, you, his brother, had Tourette's. And so I made the mistake of thinking that you probably cursed a lot involuntarily, mm-hmm. which some people with Tourette's do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I asked your brother if it was unusual to have you visiting and have you kind of cursing involuntarily in the hospital. And he kind of straightened me out and told me that that wasn't a problem that you had. And you straightened me out more in the movie because only 15% of people with Tourette's have this
right.
problem, which is called coprolalia.
Right.
But, boy, it must be really hard for that 15% of people with Tourette's who do have it.
Yeah, it's actually very difficult, extremely embarrassing, at times dangerous, and also very funny at times. I have a number of friends who have coprolalia, and especially when a lot of racial slurs are involved. There's one friend I have who lives here in New York City. She actually lives in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And she says a lot of racial slurs. And so whenever we're out together, every single, a member of a given ethnicity will pass by, and she will come out with the racial slur for that particular ethnic group, including her own and mine and anybody else's. So it can be very, very, very interesting going around town with her.
Well, you know, I think some people interpret that as, you know, well, this is what she's really thinking. Somebody else who thought that we would be able to, like, repress it, to keep it in, but because she has this neurological disorder, it comes out. But she really believes these racial epithets.
Well, I think, you know what it is? I'll give you an example that I think people can kind of grasp and understand.
Mm-hmm.
How many times have you been walking down the street and seen somebody totally bald and thought to yourself, baldy? Or seen somebody who weighs like 400 pounds and thought, fatso? These things pop into everybody's mind, but how many people would actually blurt them out?
But that's my point.
Thinks of the word.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, she thinks of the word because, you know, a lot of people would think of the word. It doesn't mean that she's against the person or that she's a racist or that she's a bigot at all. But yet the word is in the culture. It's out there. And it's already been established as a sort of label in society. So she simply has the inability to inhibit this language.
My guest is Lowell Handler, narrator of the film Twitch and Shout, a documentary about people with Tourette syndrome, which Handler has himself. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Talking about Tourette syndrome with Lowell Handler. Do you remember the first time you met somebody else who had Tourette's?
Yes, I remember that vividly, and it was very frightening for me.
Why was it frightening? I thought you were going to say the opposite.
No, actually, it was frightening because I had, you know, somewhat middle-of-the-road symptoms, and I remember I went to a Tourette Syndrome Association meeting in New York City, which is where I live now. And I went with my parents, and I remember it was very difficult for my parents too, because here was this thing that you have, that, and we really didn't know what to expect. And there was a man there who actually I'm still in touch with, a man named Bob Nast, who lives in New Jersey. And he had some very, he's a very nice guy, and he's a very intelligent man, and he had some very kind of classically severe symptoms. And he came over and introduced himself and shook my hand, said hello, and he was like, you know, mouth popping and flailing and all over the place. And I'm saying to myself, holy God, you know, is this going to happen to me? Or, you know, who knows? You know, Tourette is not degenerative. That's the first thing everybody asks. Is it degenerative? It's not degenerative, but it's constantly in a fluctuating state. Sometimes it's worse, sometimes it's better. It waxes and wanes, and it changes every day and every week, and you really don't know what to expect. So it was frightening for me, but then now I don't even give a damn anymore, really. But it just, I didn't know what to expect. It was that kind of thing.
Does anyone on the street ever assume that you're homeless because you're walking funny or because you're talking to yourself?
I think they don't think I'm homeless because of the way I'm dressed.
Right.
But I think they do think, I've had many times people react where they think I'm an alcoholic or I'm a drug addict. The other day I was in my neighborhood in the East Village, and one of the homeless guys who was panhandling, I was buying a New York Times on the corner, and he looked at me, and I was kind of barking and doing that, and he looked at me and said, "You've been drinking that vodka again, huh, buddy?" And I said, "No, have you?" You know, I mean, what am I supposed to say? But it's like everybody has some comment. Everybody wants to put in their two cents.
Part of your film is set at a national conference for people with Tourette syndrome.
Tourette's Conference.
Yeah, and it looks like a really interesting conference, and several of the people attending comment about how it's the place where they feel most comfortable in the world, because everyone at the conference has Tourette's and you don't have to explain yourself. The hotel staff understands what's going on, and so you don't have to be self-conscious about anything. Do you feel that way there, too?
Oh, definitely, yeah. And in fact, Oliver Sacks was there with us.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of like our unofficial mascot. it was a lot of fun. I mean, those conferences are incredibly exhausting and rejuvenating at the same time.
There was one discussion at the conference about the difficulty of finding a lover or a spouse. Is it usually hard for people with Tourette's to find somebody that they feel really comfortable with and who feels comfortable with them? I'm wondering, too, if you know a lot of couples who both have the syndrome.
Well, actually, you know, I think it is more difficult for people with Tourette or with any particular condition, just because it's an added difficulty. A couple of years ago, both Laurel Chaitin, the director of this film, and myself were at a wedding. And the wedding was two people who both have Tourette syndrome. And it was quite incredible. It really was, because the man actually had a severe case of Tourette syndrome, and the woman had a mild case of Tourette syndrome. And there was a rabbi conducting the service, and every single thing that was said as part of the ceremony, there was some response by the groom in relation to what was being said, so that the rabbi would say, we all look forward to these things in life, being together, and the things that we look forward to. And the groom yelled out, "Grateful Dead tapes, Grateful Dead tapes." And then he said, we've so thankful to the Tourette Syndrome Association for bringing these people together, and they've given so much. And he said, like, money, money. And you know, all kinds of hysterical things like that. And everything was like almost like a comedy routine, you know?
When we decided to do this interview, I, of course, wondered, you know, what if any symptoms would come out while we were talking? You know, would you be twitching as we talked? And you know, would there be noises being made? And now you're in a studio in a separate city from me. We're talking
right
via fiber optic line. So you're in New York, I'm Philadelphia. I haven't seen you. But there's been a couple of times when I heard, I thought a little shout or something.
Right.
But really, I mean, nothing has on the whole sounded different than a typical interview. Do things usually go that uninterrupted for you? Is it because like you're particularly focusing on the interview?
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you're disappointed.
No, actually,
it is because I'm sort of focused. But it's also because I think my Tourette is highly visual, and I think that it also tends to be very interactive, where I'm interacting with other people. So that I'm very animated and I kind of move around a lot, but when I'm kind of concentrated and asked to be contained in a setting, like in a studio like this, in a sound studio or on a train or a bus, I tend to try to keep to myself and just focus on the task at hand, yeah.
Your movie is called Twitch and Shout, which I really like the title because it's funny. And I'm wondering if you and a lot of people you know with Tourette syndrome have a sense of humor about it.
Yeah, we definitely do. I think it's both, it's a full range of things. It's very terrible, it's uncomfortable, it's awful, but it's also quite hysterical and quite funny. And I think it's all of those things at the same time.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Lowell Handler is the associate producer and narrator of the film Twitch and Shout, directed by Laurel Chaitin. It will be shown next week at Webster University in St. Louis, next month at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, and next summer it will be shown on the PBS series POV. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll have news from Boston today, Terry, about John Salvi entering a plea of not guilty. He is the man accused of killing two receptionists in a shootout at a couple of clinics that offer abortions in Massachusetts. Those clinics, by the way, reopened today. Also in the news, we will be hearing about the fighting in and around Grozny in Chechnya. And Dan Collison reports from San Diego on efforts there that were successful to unionize topless dancers.
Thanks, Robert. Those are some of the stories coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This is a good time to consider the place of Motown in American culture. Founder Berry Gordy has written his memoirs. There's a new Temptations box set. Gerald Early suspects that the meaning of Motown depends on whether you're white or African American. Early is the author of a book about Motown due out this spring. And he teaches English at Washington University, where he also directs the African American Studies program.
On June 29, 1988, when Motown Records was sold to MCA for $61 million, an era ended in America. At the time of the sale, the company was no longer a force in popular music. Indeed, it was losing money. But it had become, through those wonderful acts like the Supremes, the Miracles, the Temptations, Stevie Wonder, Martha Reeves, Marvin Gaye, a considerable force in the mind of a particular generation. Motown, I discovered, meant different things to different people. And the difference largely fell out, as is often the case in this country, along racial lines. Perhaps this difference, on the one hand, might be best illustrated by Lawrence Kasdan's film memoir of baby boomers remembering the 1960s, The Big Chill, which used Motown music as sentimental cliche markers. On the other hand, the use of Motown music in the superb 1964 film Nothing But a Man was displayed within the fabric of ordinary black working class life. Motown had the two major elements that produce a complex sentimentality in whites, musical black people and youth. For whites, Motown confirmed the charismatic charm of blacks in America. When I talk to whites about Motown, what they talk about is the Motown sound and that they were hip enough to appreciate it. But coming as it did during the high point of the civil rights movement, this music liberated many young whites from the views of their parents, from their parents' culture of whiteness, and this generational freedom was no insignificant happenstance. blacks talk of the Motown sound, too. But what my black friends say when we get together is how we built a black institution and how we marketed ourselves instead of having white folks do it and how we controlled our music instead of having white folks steal it. For whites, the importance is that the music crossed over. For blacks, that it was a successful black business. By the 1950s, the black urban community had developed to such an extent that it had the supporting structure to make a business like Motown possible. There was a network of strong black schools and churches that produced motivated youngsters who would become the artists and songwriters. There were many nightclubs and taverns that employed black musicians. There were other businesses such as charm schools, record shops, and newspapers. Black radio became an important source for making the black community a market. Finally, an insurgency movement in the early 1950s in African-American culture itself produced, on the one hand, the rhythm and blues revolution, and on the other, the civil rights movement of organized public dissent. Motown meant that urban black living had reached an extraordinary complexity of tradition, discipline, and entrepreneurship. In some ways, Motown fulfilled the Harlem Renaissance by bringing together the belief in black-owned enterprise with the belief in art as black folks' main chance to make it in America. Some of this is romanticized stuff about the black community, but within this romance resides an insight about black aspiration and the black American dream. Yet without crossing over, Motown would never have become as big as it did. As a youth, Motown freed me from the blues, rhythm and blues, and soul jazz of my parents' generation, all too adult and old-fashioned for me. Motown seemed young and joyous, something that because white kids shared it made me feel that my blackness was a part of America, not apart from it. But spreading blackness across the land made me feel that Motown was a force of empowerment, too. Alas, this is how American nostalgia truly works, and sometimes how it crosses over.
Gerald Early is a professor of English at Washington University in St. Louis. He's the author of One Nation Under a Groove, Motown and American Culture, to be published this spring by Echo Press. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I don't like
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.